You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy one, candy one. Many stones can form an arch, singly none.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum this evening. I am Jen Zaman, and I am in for Judy Ansel tonight. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Painters District Council 3 and Sheet Metal Workers Local 2. Painters and allied trades representing painters, drywall finishers, glaziers, floor layers, and sign display and industrial workers. Quality craftsmen and women putting the finishing touches on KC for over 100 years. And Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 represents 1,200 members in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly anything out of it for industry, heating and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, standardized testing. Why are students and teachers around the country so critical of it? This week, we will have two teachers discuss how testing strips important protections from teachers and vital experiences from students. Find out why they applaud students who walk out on tests and colleges which don't require SAT scores, and why they want your help protecting public education. In the news, MU grad students vote union, and new study finds that Illinois union members get a 600% return on their union dues. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now it's the news.
Graduate students at the University of Missouri have voted in favor of the Coalition of Graduate Workers as their official collective bargaining agent. The Heartland Labor Forum interviewed two CGW organizers on March 3rd. Their organizing began last August when MU unexpectedly announced it would be eliminating health insurance subsidies for graduate students. A number of protests and student strikes followed, and the university reinstated the health insurance website's subsidies. Within 2 weeks, an effort to form a union began with the help of the Missouri NEA. Grad students raised questions about other issues like child care. This week, following a two-day election managed by the League of Women Voters, the Coalition of Graduate Workers won a decisive victory. 84% of the 795 grad student workers who voted favored the union. 30% of those eligible voted. The university had previously announced that it didn't recognize graduate students as employees and refused to follow procedures set out in Missouri law or the Missouri Constitution's provision granting all workers the right to organize and bargain. On April 15th, MU System Interim President Mike Middleton said, "The problem is that in the state of Missouri, it's not clear that students have a right to collectively bargain." CGW co-chair Eric Scott said, "I can only hope that the end result of it is that the university looks at this result and understands that this is what is best for everyone." The CGW will start building the union by electing a bargaining team, coordinating committee, and representative assembly, and get ready to bargain. If MU continues to refuse to bargain, it's a good bet. Legal action will follow.
For 9 years, the FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, has been trying to get Reynolds Tobacco to the table to discuss the deplorable conditions in its supply chain for workers who work in the tobacco fields in North Carolina. In 2012, Reynolds finally agreed to talk, but little has come of it. So once again this year, on May 5th, FLOC will invade the boardroom at Reynolds' annual meeting and fill the streets with protesters. Reynolds is one of the largest tobacco companies with brands like Camel, Kool, and American Spirit. Last year at the protest, Justin Flores of the FLOC said, "We want them to talk about the true cost of doing business. They have a responsibility for what goes through their supply chain." Tobacco workers often grapple with poor housing, low wages, and unsafe working conditions. Many are foreigners who come on temporary H-2A work visas. Some are lured by false promises and even pay third-party contractors for placement in the tobacco fields. FLOC wants Reynolds to commit to protect workers' freedom of association and right to protected, concerted activity at its independently operated farms, the committee says. As it stands, Flores says retaliation is rampant for farm workers who speak out about labor conditions. In most cases, it's also legal. Farm workers aren't covered by major federal labor laws. They're exempt from overtime, and the National Labor Relations Act excluded them in deference to Southern congressmen back in the 30s when most cotton was picked by blacks. Reynolds, of course, says the FLOC's proposal to guarantee organizing rights on farms is unlawful and unworkable. They recommend that workers address their complaints to the farmers who employ them and who contract with Reynolds. This ignores that it's Reynolds that sets the price and in large part determines the conditions for workers and farmers alike.
Here's an interesting new study by Frank Manzo of the Illinois Economic Policy Institute and Bob Bruno of the Labor Education Service at the University of Illinois. It finds that for every dollar an Illinois worker pays in union dues, he or she gets $6.12 back in better wages and benefits. According to PAI, that's a return on investment, a common term in the financial world, of more than 600%, far above what investors get from stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The study is called Application and Impact of Labor Union Dues in Illinois. It has found that much of Illinois' 258 union locals collected in dues and how much the unions spend on collective bargaining, administering their contracts, and everything else. Then they compared the spending to the wages and benefits Illinois' 744,439 unionized workers earned versus their non-union counterparts. The reports covered fiscal year 2014, which began October 1, 2013, the last full data available. That year, 15.2% of Illinois workers were unionized. That was one of the highest densities in the U.S. They reported that the average Illinois unionist paid $663 in union dues, fees, and other payments that year, about $55 per month. But that same unionist earned $4,060 more after taxes than his or her non-union counterpart. The Illinois unionists were also 14% more likely to have health insurance and 2% less likely to rely on food stamps than their non-union colleagues. And they found that only 2% of union spending that year went for politics and lobbying, and those dollars are voluntarily given, not mandated, the professors noted. Bruno and Manzo also reported union members independently create nearly 43,000 additional jobs that would not exist in Illinois without unionization. Those include 10,000 workers at union halls and 33,000 jobs due to the higher spending by union households. The higher pay for unionists also added $218 million to state income tax revenue, the report says. Any attempt to weaken labor organizations in Illinois, if successful, would reduce these positive impacts that union members have on the state, the professors concluded.
And on April 13th, 39,000 Verizon workers went on strike in the Northeast U.S. They are members of the Communication Workers and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The striking workers mainly deal with landline operations and FIOS installations, and the dispute centers around the way Verizon has treated their employees. Verizon has been outsourcing call center jobs and pushing workers to relocate across the country for months. For months at a time. The union says all the while company increases its focus on its wireless business and continues to push self-serve digital customer service. Dennis Traynor, CWA vice president, said, "If a hugely profitable corporations like Verizon can destroy good family-supporting jobs of highly skilled workers, then no worker in America will be safe from these corporate race to the bottom." Tonight's news was read by Shacklin Hams, Jen Zaman, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Molly Madden.
Hello, this is Jacob White, and you are listening to Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI. Jesse Hagopian teaches history and is the co-advisor to the Black Student Union at Garfield High School. the site of the historic boycott of the MAP test in 2013, and is an associate editor for the acclaimed Rethinking Schools magazine. Jesse is the editor of and contributing author to More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High-Stakes Testing, and a founding member of the Social Equality Educators, a recipient of the 2012 Abe Keller Foundation Award for Excellence in Innovation in Peace Education, and won the 2013 Secondary School Teacher of the Year Award and the Special Achievement Courageous Leadership Award from the Academy of Education, Arts, and Sciences. In 2015, Jesse received the Seattle King County NAACP Award and was named an Education Fellow to the Progressive Magazine, as well as a Cultural Freedom Fellow for the Lannan Foundation for his nationally recognized work in promoting critical thinking and opposing high-stakes testing. We are lucky to have Jesse join us to tell us the latest about the movement against high-stakes testing, which Jesse believes excludes kids from low-income or minority backgrounds from important educational and career opportunities.
So, how much testing is happening in public schools, and how has this changed over your time as a teacher?
Yeah, the explosion of standardized testing in the American public school system has been breathtaking. I mean, my first year as a teacher was the first year that No Child Left Behind came online. And ever since, we've just seen the steady increase of a test and punish model, to the point where today the average American public school student from their pre-K to high school career takes 112 standardized tests, an outlandish amount of standardized testing that is robbing kids of valuable instruction time and is simply there to enrich private testing companies to rank and sort our children. And not to educate them.
And what kind of things do students miss out on because they have to spend so much time on tests?
I mean, the hyper-focus on math and reading with these exams has really been to the detriment of the arts. So we've seen funding to arts and drama and music cut across the country. We've seen the curriculum get narrowed to what's on the test because if a teacher's evaluation or their pay are connected to these tests, if a school can be shut down because of these tests, if a student can be denied graduation because of these tests, then the teacher is forced to teach not to the student, not to their passion, but they're forced to teach to the test. And what that does is really narrow the curriculum and make it rather dull. And that means that students are less engaged in class. They're just learning how to eliminate wrong answer choices. They're learning skills of rote memorization. And they're not really learning critical thinking, creativity, collaboration. All the things we really value most outside of school are disappearing inside of school.
And you argue that test and punish, it impacts different schools differently. And in particular, you've been trying to shine a light on how testing is harmful for schools that serve students of color. Can you talk more about how it exacerbates inequalities?
Absolutely. I mean, this hit home for me because a study came out in Seattle that showed that recess was quickly disappearing in elementary schools. And it wasn't random which schools. It was schools that primarily served low-income students and students of color. Yes. And as my son was getting ready to go into kindergarten last year, I was really worried about this inequality, and as it turns out, this is something that's being replicated around the country as students are increasingly forced into test prep. They're cutting lunch time and recess time to do that, and many studies have shown the dramatic benefits that kids get from unstructured free play time in terms of their problem solving, their social emotional development, and also when they have those rests, they're better able to focus when they get into the classroom. So recess is one of the casualties of this test and punish model. But it goes far beyond that. I mean, you can look at school districts like Chicago, where they closed 49 schools with the stroke of a pen, all schools that they had labeled failing with these impractical and really skewed standardized tests, and they shut down all these schools, and 87% of the schools they closed were majority black schools. And, you know, that's happened in school districts around the country. And a study came out of Boston University which shows the number one outcome of tying high stakes to exit exams required for student graduation is actually increased incarceration rates. And we live in a country that has more black people behind bars than were slaves on plantations in 1850. And part of the reason for this explosion in incarceration rates has been the school-to-prison pipeline, which is a system of underfunding schools in black and brown neighborhoods, registering that underfunding with high-stakes tests, and then closing their schools or denying kids graduation and shipping what they see as surplus people into prisons. And that's an outrageous system that we have to stand against.
And that's sort of at the, you know, the most harmed people and slightly less impactful on a large majority, but possibly influencing a lot of kids still, is how the SAT and the ACT can, if you have low scores, that can keep you out of college. But lately, more colleges have been turning away from those tests. So could you fill us in on that?
Absolutely. I mean, many studies have shown that the SAT is not a good predictor of how well you'll do in college. What does the SAT measure? Well, the first thing it measures is, do your parents have the money to buy you SAT prep classes where you can get advanced training in how to eliminate wrong answer choices, how to spot the distractor question. And you can be trained to learn how to spot distractor questions and eliminate them at better rates than other students. Which has very little to do with intelligence, aptitude, skills, learning.
Right.
And in fact, studies have shown that your performance in your classroom is a far better predictor of how well you'll do in college. And so many colleges are actually dropping the SAT as a requirement because of how it basically just sorts for wealth and proximity to the dominant culture. And I think people should really know the origin of the SAT test. Where did standardized testing come from? How did it enter the public schools? When you answer that question, you'll know how absurd it is that they can prop these tests up as some sort of instrument for equality. But in fact, a man named Carl Brigham was the founder of the SAT exam, and he was also one of the leading eugenicists in America, right? Eugenics, the pseudoscience that was designed to prove white supremacy. And so he was a professor at Princeton, and he wrote a book called The Study in American Intelligence, which lamented that Europe was outstripping America in intelligence because America had too many black people. And he designed the SAT, which had the desired results of proving that wealthy people were smarter than low-income people, that white people were smarter than black people, that native-born were smarter than immigrants. And, of course, we know that what his tests were actually measuring were access to resources in the dominant culture, much the way the tests do today. Only today they tell us these are instruments of a new civil rights movement, rather than being proud that this is a tool of white supremacy. But if you know that history, I think you can see how linked the testing system is with that disgraceful past.
And it, like you said, it's a pseudoscience because it confirms already existing biases. And I was just wondering how that plays out today in terms of budget cuts and things like that. Like, how much of it is because these things are already predisposed to affect people in a certain way that then plays itself out in affecting schools' budgets?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I live in Washington State, where our state Supreme Court has found the state legislature in contempt of court for refusing to adequately fund the public school system.
Wow.
So here we have a legal ruling and decision that they are systematically underfunding our schools, and yet we're going to be held to a Common Core test that will be denying students graduation. And so we really have an accountability system in this country that holds those with the most power the least accountable.
Right.
It wants to hold students accountable and deny them graduation, but the state legislature is breaking the constitution of our state in terms of funding education, and they walk around free. And that's an absurdity. Moreover, across the country, schools are funded by property taxes.
Right.
So the schools in the wealthy neighborhoods get better funding. And the schools in poor neighborhoods are cut off from vital resources to educate our kids. And real education reform would start with addressing that absurdity. I mean, why do wealthy people send their kids to private schools? Because at those schools, they have small class sizes.
Right.
They have flourishing arts programs. And they don't have standardized testing. They don't have to use the Common Core and the tests that come with it.
I think I read somewhere a saying that was like, don't educate your kids the way that the wealthy tell you to. Educate them the way that they have their own kids educated.
That's right. That's right. And that's how you know that it's a big con game. The hypocrisy of the testocracy, as I call them, these corporate reformers, philanthropists like the Walton family, Eli Broad, and Bill Gates, who are promoting the use of high-stakes standardized testing and Common Core tests for our children, but shield their own children from these tests by sending them to schools that don't use all these tests, should tell you all you need to know about their agenda.
I think a lot of people would be hesitant at the idea of totally eliminating tests overall. So what is your, briefly, your vision of what a more wholesome test would look like?
Yeah, and I would oppose eliminating tests altogether as well. Teachers invented tests, and we're not opposed to assessment. But what we are opposed to is the inundation of the classroom with high-stakes standardized tests.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do demand is authentic assessments. We want assessments that actually help us understand the thought process, that help promote critical thinking. And we have a desire for a testing system that looks more like what happens when you get your PhD. At that level, They want you to be able to think. They don't want to know, can you spot distractor questions better? Because you won't need to do that in your real life. They want to know, can you make an argument? Can you back it up with evidence? Can you find research to support it? And then can you defend your dissertation? Mm-hmm. And there's innovative schools around the country, like the New York Consortium for Performance-Based Assessment, network of some 38 schools in New York that use that performance-based model based on the PhD, where the students do research over time, they collaborate with peers and a mentor, they develop a thesis, and then they defend that thesis to experts, bringing in outside community members. So if you're in a language arts class, they might bring in an author from New York to help ask questions and challenge you on certain issues. And if the testocracy was right, if the key to accountability and high performance in the public schools was the use of these tests, well, the New York Consortium schools would be the worst schools in the state because they have a waiver and they don't have to give the state tests, and they use the performance model instead. But the problem for the testocracy is these are the very best schools in New York State by so many measures. They have the highest graduation rates, they have the highest college attendance rates, the highest rates of college completion, and the performance of their students of color is off the charts. They have 86% of their black graduates accepted into college compared to 37% nationally.
Wow. Last question for you. So, Lily Garcia recently gave an interview. She's the president of the NEA, and she was talking here, and she said, testing has come to a screeching halt for no other reason than it was such a catastrophe. Parents, for the first time in the history of history, were organizing to say, my children will not be tested. Everything was done so poorly that Republicans, Democrats, and President Obama agreed to stop doing stupid things. Do you agree with Ms. Garcia that we're going to start seeing a decline in testing and that it's coming to a halt?
Well, I have to say I was shocked to see President Obama come out with a statement that, in fact, the teachers he remembers most are not the ones that helped him score well on a standardized test, but the ones that nurtured him and inspired him. And that we have too much standardized testing in our schools. That was an incredible statement from somebody who has spent his career promoting high-stakes standardized tests, using Race to the Top program to bribe states with desperately needed funds to increase the amount of testing, and then, you know, backing Common Core and the high-stakes test that came with it. To see him backpedal was truly amazing and a testament to how powerful this opt-out movement has become. You know, it's the largest uprising against high-stakes testing in U.S. history. There were over 600,000 parents that opted their kids out of tests last year. And so we're clearly having an impact, but I would say that we are a long way from wresting control of the public school system from the testocracy. I mean, the average student taking 112 standardized tests is still a reality, and these tests are being implemented at the state level, but also at the district level with individual contracts. And we have a long way to go before we have fully authentic assessments driving education.
For more about Jesse's work, you can visit his website, IamAnEducator.com. You can also reach him by sending him an email to jesse@rethinkingschools.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jesse D. Hagopian.
We are what we are.
Hi, this is Jacob White, and you are listening to KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. For the second half of this show, I went back into the Heartland Labor Forum archives and pulled some clips about the different actions and policies public school teachers have pushed for in Missouri and Kansas over the past few years. This first clip is from a forum our own Judy Ansel hosted on this radio show, Heartland Labor Forum, January 23rd, 2014, entitled Public Education, Is This the End?
So, welcome to all of you. And throughout this conversation, we want to keep in mind the children. We're talking about what's best for education of K through 12 children in Kansas City, Missouri. And we're going to start by trying to get a little background on the problem. And I want to ask each of you, what are the basic reasons you think that the Kansas City School District is in so much trouble and has been unaccredited? Let's start with you, Jan.
I don't think that there's anything that is as important as dealing with the poverty level that is in Kansas City and most other urban districts. In Kansas City, for instance, 89% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch, while the state average is 50%. The state average for racial and ethnic background is 26.3, and Kansas City's is 91. We have a high rate of English language learners, 23%. The state average is 2.9. And I've recently heard a statistic that any urban school district that had a poverty rate of 90% is not doing well.
So it isn't just our problem.
No,
it's an urban problem.
It is not. It is an urban
poverty problem. And let me just get a little background. You're from Moore Squared, an education task force. What do they do, just briefly?
Moore Square is Metro Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, and so we work on a variety of issues. The Education Task Force has been a task force for about 9 years now. We originally started working on dropout prevention, had a bill that was passed in the state legislature, but it has never been funded. And since then, we have been concentrating on the Kansas City School District.
Okay, great. Miriam, what do you think is behind all of this and has caused the district to become unaccredited?
Well, the Kansas City School District's reputation precedes itself. At this point, it seems as if, sometimes if I tell people my kids go to Kansas City School District, you know, the look of horror fills their face. My experience has been different. The schools my children have attended in the district were not only serving their educational needs, but their needs as a community member. Being a parent, you have to decide where you're going to raise your children. And I purposefully moved to Midtown, and I wanted my children to have a neighborhood experience. And, you know, it does take a lot of oversight for me, but, you know, to make sure I feel confident they're getting educated, but we've had good experience with the district.
Okay. Andrea, how long have you been associated with the district?
Longer than I care to admit. I think it's probably been close to 34 years.
Ah, really?
Yeah. And
so
I taught for 31.
Okay, and how many different schools did you teach in?
Actually, not as many as you would think. It was pretty stable. My first year, I was moved several times, and I was probably in about four schools, a couple of schools for more than 10 years.
Okay. So what's your analysis of why the district is unaccredited?
You know, it's interesting because if there was an easy answer, we wouldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are a host of reasons why we're at where we're at. I agree with Jan on that poverty is a huge issue, and it presents great challenges in a lot of our schools. But I also, I think part of what's going on here is people think – that we're the district that they used to hear about, and they don't recognize that this district is moving in directions that are really good for children. I don't think the district understands that. I mean, even if you're looking at being unaccredited, we're held to the same bar as you know, Lee Summit is or Blue Springs is, and we have a lot of subgroups. As Jen said, we have a lot of ELL students, English language learners.
You know what percentage are English language learners?
Yeah, that's right at 24%, 23.9%.
So 1/4 of those kids who are taking tests
absolutely
are not native English speakers.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you have to realize state average is like 2.9%.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Okay. And they don't make it. They can be here for 1 year without taking the test, and then they have to take the test. So, you know, it requires a lot more resources to get those kids where they need to be. I think the other thing, a lot of our kids, they come to us below grade level, so we're playing catch up from the very beginning. And again, it goes back to a lot of those things that are associated with the communities that they live in, which are often violent and associated with drugs and gangs and things like that. It's a very complicated answer. And it takes, but I do want to say I think the district has done a lot of things in moving in the right directions, and this community seems very slow to recognize that.
Okay, great. Danny, representing Ethan Gray from SeaTrust, what was his analysis?
Well, he says in our report named "The Conditions for Success," we profile several of the nation's highest performing urban schools. Schools where nearly every child is growing up in a low-income home, yet nearly every child is achieving at high levels and accessing college. What do these schools have in common? Educators are in charge of all major decisions, and the schools are held meaningfully accountable for student achievement results. Some of these schools are charters, some are district schools, some are unionized, some are not. What matters is not the type of school or whether it is unionized, and they say that's something that they support, but whether educators are in charge and whether the school is held accountable. Kansas City Public Schools is a top-down, command and control, traditional urban district. District administrators make most of the decisions about curriculum, culture, calendar, and staffing. Educators are not treated like professionals, as they are not given much agency to make key decisions about the educational programming.
Okay, so his analysis would be that the problem is really the administration and the model of administration. And, you know, I have to say, Andrea, that I've heard the union complain about the same thing a number of times. So do you have any kind of response to that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Judy, I do have a couple of responses, because you're right. So often it has been top down. And that it's really collaboration at the site level that's important. What's interesting is that supposedly the SeaTrust had done a study of Kansas City, and I find that hard to believe, because I think there's a lot of collaboration going on in a lot of schools right now. In fact, they're happening every single day. Teachers are having conversations about what's working in their classroom, what our kids' needs are. So, you know, I find it really difficult to believe that he even dug deep into what is actually happening in our schools, because you're right, collaboration at that school level with administration makes all the difference in the world.
On February 19th, 2015, Lon Swearingen hosted Teachers Union Leaders for a conversation titled "The Battle for Public Education in Missouri and Kansas." Listen to this show and think about how much things have changed, or how little they've changed, in terms of funding issues and classroom size issues from February of 2015 to today.
Why is it important to preserve and extend public education for our society?
Well, public education is essential. You know, you're not only trying to create our workforce for the future, but we're also trying to create citizens and good people and good neighbors and good community members. And it just can't be underestimated, you know, the importance of doing that and doing that well. Our children need to be able to realize their potentials wherever they are and whatever that potential is. And to not do that is just a travesty. As I saw a letter to the editor recently where they said, you know, that we're eating our seed corn. And I thought that made a lot of sense in Kansas, but you just can't do that. You've got to give your children the opportunity to become future business people and future community members.
Yeah, so how can our listeners plug into the activities that you're having, and especially the walk at the end of March?
They can, if they're on Facebook, we have a large presence on Facebook. It's under our name, Game On for Kansas Schools, and they can message us there if they want to get involved in the walk particularly. They can also, if they're not on Facebook, we also have a website. It's www.gameonforkansasschools.com, and there's a contact us button on there as well.
Okay, well, Judith, thank you so much. You've given us a lot of information and a lot of hope that we're creating the kind of society we need and want. So we really appreciate you doing this organizing work.
Thank you.
Very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Our next guest, Mark Jones, says that the funding for public education in Missouri is outspent by every other state with the exception of Mississippi. Mark is the political director of the Missouri National Education Association.
Mark gives an overview of the critical issues facing public schools in Missouri.
What bills caused most harm to public education now that are in the legislature?
Sure. Well, I think first what we're seeing move through the legislature are a series of bills that fail to address the fundamental problem with education in the state of Missouri, which is we are not meeting our bare minimum adequacy target. So in 2004, Matt Blunt, along with the Republican legislature, rewrote how we're supposed to fund schools in Missouri. And they set a new target, which was lower than it had ever been before. And they failed to meet that target. We're already $405 million below what we should be for funding our schools in the state of Missouri. Now we have had bills in the past couple years passed that put in special triggers and treat school districts differently. So now we have a series of school districts across the state that may lose a couple hundred million dollars of funding, while school districts that are quote-unquote hold harmless are able to hold on to their money, and really what we're seeing now is they're punishing districts for being poor, and that's not the way we think school district funding should be for in the state of Missouri. On specific bills, what we're seeing is this transfer issue that folks in Kansas City might be familiar with through the Kansas City School District. When the Kansas City School District was on the verge of becoming unaccredited, it was unsure if they were going to regain their provisional accreditation. There was a concern that the neighboring districts would have to accept students from the Kansas City School District. Now, we saw a similar situation in St. Louis with that, at the Normandy schools. And what ended up happening was because of the transfers and the tuition in the receiving school districts being so high, it ended up bankrupting the Normandy School District. And there was a lot of fear that we will bankrupt the Kansas City School District. Now, fortunately, Kansas City seems to be on the right trajectory. However, that law is still on the books, and they're trying to fix it in the legislature right now. However, since it's an education bill that a lot of folks want to see fixed so school districts go bankrupt, we're seeing a lot of bad policy being hung on it like a sad Christmas tree ornament. And so we're seeing ideas around expanding the privatization of education into unaccountable charter schools or virtual schools. We're also starting to see a lot of efforts to take public property, like school buildings that taxpayers have paid for and built, and see either forced lease or forced sale of those buildings to private or unaccountable charters. And those are really issues that we're looking at as detrimental to the public good for education and for students. Additionally, we're seeing attacks on the ability for educators to have a voice in the legislature through something called paycheck deception, which would create onerous and burdensome red tape for educators who just want to be a member of the Missouri National Education Association or other unions that serve as public employees in the state of Missouri. And those are really just punitive efforts, because we've seen education and public employees unions on the front line of protecting services and protecting students in the state. And there are just some of the legislature who oppose that and want to act as a punitive measure to make it harder for us to retain our membership.
So can you tell us about the current campaigns the National Education Association is waging in Missouri?
Sure. Well, there's one big one that we're waging not just in Missouri but across the country, and that's fixing No Child Left Behind. Congress is looking at the elementary and secondary education is actively going after the amount of student testing that the state mandates here in Missouri. And so we have a campaign to work with not only educators but parents and students on how to effectively advocate for reduced testing in the state of Missouri. The Missouri NEA, in association with other education groups, has worked very hard to push the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education to reduce the amount of standardized testing and instead focus on testing that is created by the educators in the classroom, that is teacher-driven, and is really about the curriculum that local school district has. So we're very much pushing for a local control of how curriculum is designed and how it's assessed. And that way, educators have access to the information right there and are able to actually help a student immediately who may be either struggling with an issue or maybe struggling with content. And we're looking, and those are both campaigns we're doing across the state and will be very active over the coming years.
What's the state of educationally in Missouri as compared with other states for children, for unionized teachers?
Well, unfortunately, Missouri is trending in the wrong direction. We're constantly at the bottom of the pile in how much we compensate educators, how much we spend on students from the state level, and what percentage of a student's cost of educating a student comes from the state level. Instead of looking at other states who are constantly working to ensure the state is doing everything they can to make education a priority, particularly K-12, but in some states even higher ed, we are slipping lower and lower and lower. What the consequence that has been is that on the local level, taxpayers have had to pass local bond and levies just to stay even because of the state continuously shortfalls students and parents year after year. In the last decade, we've easily underfunded our schools by over $1.5 billion. And at some point, it's just like a road or anything else. You can only delay that investment in infrastructure so long before you start seeing potholes and cracks. And we're getting to the point where districts have done everything they can to ensure funds are moving into the classroom. And now they're at a point where they're having to go back to taxpayers and max out the amount they can ask property owners to pay in property tax. And we're just at a point where the state is fundamentally not doing its share of the lift to fund our K-12 programs and to fund higher education. And really what we're seeing is every year Missouri slips lower and lower and lower on that list to where now we're just beating out Mississippi in state aid and state funding. And that's just not, I think, the company we want to be keeping. When we look at other states around the country, we want to be leading the way in what we're investing in our students and in their future. And instead, we keep seeing other states surpass us because they've buckled down and realized that they have to fund their K-12 schools, and they have to make sure that money is going to the classroom and helping the students have the best equipment possible in the classroom, the best materials, and the best educators.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, in mourning with the passing of the great rock and roll singer Prince, I am here with a heavy heart to talk to you a little bit about a very important Supreme Court case that was argued just on Monday, and that is the case of the United States versus Texas. This is the case that is about Obama's executive action from November of 2014 that would have expanded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that was instituted in 2012 and also created a new deferred action plan
formal or that would be known as Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, or DAPA. Now, this case has been slowly working its way through courts since pretty much it was announced in 2014, right before it was planning on being instituted in February of 2015. There was a lawsuit about it in the Fifth Circuit that effectively stopped the institution of the new guidelines, the expanded DACA and the new deferred action plan, the new deferred action for parents. So it's finally gotten to the Supreme Court. This is a situation where now we are going to have a decision by June about this particular case. Now, the death of Scalia has complicated this, but not necessarily put an end to it, because, to be honest, he was not, I mean, everybody knows he was not going to find in favor of this anyways. So I'm not sure that it necessarily changed the outcome in people that are looking to want this case to go through. So basically, there are three questions that they are arguing. First, do state governments have the right to sue the federal government to challenge how it enforces or fails to enforce a federal law? Now, that's a question under the Constitution, under the Article 3. Second, and that's what you might have heard if you've been watching the news about this, something called standing. Do the states have standing to sue about this? Second, does the 2014 program and the expansion of the 2012 program go beyond the powers that Congress has given to the president and his aide under the federal immigration law? In other words, did President Obama need Congress's approval to go ahead with this new program? Did he overstep his bounds in executive authority? Third, are the programs illegal under federal law because the public was not given a chance to comment on these? In agency law, which is what immigration is, there's a process where the public has a chance to comment in the rulemaking process, and that, of course, didn't happen because this is an exercise of executive power. Now, I was expecting, to be honest, a lot more talk about is this an illegal or an overstretch of executive power. But it seemed like the arguments were more focused on two specific things. And that was, the first big one was whether or not the states actually have standing. And it seemed that the more liberal justices were really focused in on this. And that was whether or not the states have actually been harmed in any way. Because the fact is, they sued before this went into effect. And so nothing has happened. So they're not out anything. They're not out any money. They're not out any effort. They're not out anything at all. So do the states actually have standing to step in and make a lawsuit about something that hasn't happened yet? There was a lot of questions related to that. And then a kind of broader issue is, do states have standing in general to sue the federal government about how they enforce specific federal laws? That seemed to be getting a lot of traction with the more liberal justices, and who is likely to be the swing vote in this, and the one that may push it over to the five to three vote, Justice Kennedy. excuse me. The other thing that the two more conservative people, Roberts and Alito, were asking, they were kind of getting hung up. They were more focused on, is this an exercise of something that Congress should have done rather than the president? So in other words, did Obama overstep his executive authority? And they were really getting hung up on a term in the provision called lawfully present, because there's a part in the DAPA that says the DAPA status would give lawful presence. It's a reason why people hate lawyers, because there's some hair splitting about what that means. In any case, those are the big two issues. If they decide it based on standing, it presents an interesting question, because they really haven't decided on whether or not Obama overstepped his authority. They just decided that the state shouldn't have been able to sue. So it would mean that DAPA might be able to go into effect, but that the states might be able to sue once it does. So it creates an interesting quandary, because it hasn't been decided actually on the merits. That's all the time we have for tonight. This will be an interesting case, and it will be sure to have an opinion before the end of June. And I will be talking about it more, I'm sure, then. I'm Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams. Thank you, be safe, and good night.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 21st, 2016. Faith and labor Breakfast, Thursday, April 28th, 7:30 p.m., Sheet Metal Workers, 2902 Blue Ridge Cutoff, KCMO. Cross-border Network May Day Dinner, Friday, April 29th, 6 to 8 p.m., and that's at the Visionary Impact Theater, 1017 North 6th Street, Kansas City, Kansas. Central American Food, Spoken Word with Norma Cantu, and Music by Subtropicales. For tickets, go to crossbordernetwork.org. Celebrate May Day with Mother Jones, Saturday, April 30th, 12 to 4 p.m., Mother Jones Museum, Mount Olive, Illinois. If you can get there. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, Tuesday, May 3rd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Confronting Extremist Violence, the Refugee Crisis and Fear, Faith Responses, Thursday, May 19th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., Kansas City Public Library, Plaza Branch. That's at 6:30 to 8 p.m. Great Labor Arts Exchange, June 23rd to 25th, Washington, D.C., at ATU, Tommy Douglas Center, all musicians and labor artists. This is for you, www.laborheritage.org. And that's the calendar for tonight.
Okay, thanks, Molly. And thanks, Angie, for that insightful segment. Tune in next week to Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be Innovations in Labor from this year's Jobs with Justice Conference. And I have been your engineer and host tonight, Jen Zaman, and Judy will be returning next week.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.